material, again, I keep saying I did not learn the seminary. Guys think I never went to seminary, but, you know, I'm not sure we covered it, but it certainly wasn't this. This is fascinating because this is really our story. It's the story how we as Methodists came to be, and it's in several parts. So we're going to do a little bit of review of last week because I know all of you weren't here, and then we're going to launch right into Mr. Whitfield. So where we are in this series that was going to be about 7 months, it looks like it's going to come in more at about 11, somewhere in there, is we're examining kind of where we are today in terms of how the religion developed in the modern world. And particularly we're at that point now, and we will be for another 5 weeks, 6 weeks, another 6 weeks, Methodism. How did it come to be? How was it? So, and Tim's going to be helping with that too. So the story of how it is that we emerged in England really in the late 1730s and the early 1740s. It's not a long period of time. It's relatively quick. We grew out of a larger social religious phenomenon that nobody had ever seen anything like it. In America, we know it as the Great Awakening. And you can read that and study it, and you did in school. In England, it had a different name. It was called the Evangelical Revival. It's essentially the same thing, with many of the same characters playing a role like Whitfield. Slightly different. In England, it's more a movement within the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church, Church of England. And it's Arminian, the kind of theology we have. However, in America, it is much more Reformed theology, Calvinistic. And it's embraced by those churches, and the Anglican church doors were closed to this movement. So it has two different kind of flavors, but it's essentially the same thing. And the main character in both, the main character is the exact same person. So last week we explored the origins of the Great Awakening in America, because it starts in America and very quickly comes to England. And it's going to kind of do shuttle diplomacy. It's going to go back and forth, you know, depending on where Mr. Whitfield is at the moment. So, who here remembers shuttle diplomacy? Yeah. I said that the other day, a group of six people. None of them had heard of it. They were all too young. Okay. Mr. Kissinger. Okay. Here's the short version of last week. By the mid-1600s, a century after the Reformation, there is a growing awareness, a consensus among Protestants on the continent, in England, and in America, that things were not well, and that the Reformation had lost its momentum, it had lost its steam, it had lost its spirit. And so because of that, what we needed a new Reformation, and that language is actually used. But we didn't need what we had back in the 1500s. We didn't need to revive the institution of the church. That had been done with minimal effect, many people would say. It's not just a business about reviving the institution. With the influence of Pietism, which we saw coming in the 1600s, Pietism is now beginning to seep out of the Pietist movement and to be embraced by a growing number of people. A lot of them, like the Wesleys, are in university settings, like Oxford. But it's felt that what's needed is a renewal not of the institution of the church, but a renewal of the individual. And this is, in true Pietist language, is linked to what's called heart faith, a renewal of the human heart. So, not institutional, but individual. This is a different kind of Reformation. By the late 1600s, generation later, there is a growing expectation. Again, Europe, England, America, it's all over. And it's both sides of the Atlantic. This is why this happens both sides simultaneously. There's an expectation that God's Spirit is about to break loose, because one of the things people believed is an outpouring of God's Spirit was generally preceded by a period of spiritual decline. And because there was a broad consensus that we were in a period of spiritual decline, the expectation was maybe God would break forth in this moment. And that the faithful, this is something I had not realized in the research, a piece of this belief is, which is odd, because in America, this is among Calvinists, and you would think their doctrine of predestination would preclude, but never expect people to be systematic, okay? The expectation is, not only is God going to bring an outpouring of the Spirit, but we can help. We have a role to play. That just sounds Arminian, doesn't it? Yeah, Holy Spirit, doctrine of the Holy Spirit, yeah. Church members could do this by praying down God's Spirit, Remember the language of that guy last year? Fetch down. Remember that? You could fetch down the things of God through prayer. So we're going to pray mightily that God will bring a revival. Now, preachers, pastors had a different one. You got to preach them up to the front, preacher. You got to change how you're preaching. This is not about intellect. This is not about knowledge. This is about the heart. That's a different kind of sermon. Now, we know that today because we get those sermons. But back then, this was a relatively radical kind of move. That idea had been pioneered in the Pietist movement, but now it's kind of gotten out of the Pietist box. It's out there. Beginning in 1679, there began to be a series of about 20 or so awakenings. They just sort of bubble up here and they bubble up there. And they're in New England. They start in what will eventually become the state of Massachusetts. At this point, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, there's no boundary line. The first awakening is Northampton, Massachusetts, and Solomon Stoddard was the pastor. Anybody heard of him before? Until last week. Who's his grandson? Jonathan Edwards. Sinners in the hand of an angry God. Okay, yeah. Solomon Stoddard is the guy who begins to preach revival, being born again. He does it pretty academically because he is, in fact, a Calvinist, and they're pretty head-oriented. And lo and behold, people respond. And it begins to put first six, then a dozen, something like that. Okay. He's the grandfather, Jonathan Edwards. Now, people begin to respond not just in Northampton, but in other places in Massachusetts. This thing begins to grow, begins to pop around, and we begin having people having conversion experiences. Remember, one of the key beliefs of Pietism was what? The conversion experience. Now, within Lutheran traditions and other traditions, it was kind of understood, this is how you get converted. You're going to talk to the pastor week after week after week after week after week after week for years, you know, and conversion happens slowly. Well, if conversion is based on intellect and knowledge, that's slow. But if conversion is based on feeling and heart, that can be instantaneous. And the Moravian Pietists are the first to pioneer that kind of belief. These early awakenings are sporadic and they're limited, but it is clear something's going on. Something is about to erupt. 1733, bam, it happens. The 2 years between 1733 and 1735, this is referred to as the Great or the General Awakening. Later it'll be called the Great Awakening. It's going to erupt in the colonies, and again, where's the church that starts? Same place the first bubble up came, back at Northampton. By this time, this is the seventh awakening at that church. Stoddard has stepped down. His grandson, Jonathan Edwards, is now the pastor, young man. Okay. The key figure of the revival at this point is Jonathan Edwards. He's the key player. His preaching focused on an awakening grace of God. Now, if you read Jonathan Edwards' sermons, it doesn't sound anything like you would think in terms of the emotion stuff. It's very academic. It's very intellectual. But he's preaching about an awakening and about the necessity for conversion and for being born again. You know, he wrote an account of the revival. The revival happens for about 2 years, off and on. And then when it's over, he sits down and writes one of the most remarkable and influential books in Christian history. He writes what is called A Faithful Narrative. Remember last week, the actual name was like 75 words, you know, kind of long, but just we'll call it The Faithful Narrative for short. Basically, it's the story of what happened. I mean, everybody's aware, ooh, wow, what the heck was that? Well, he writes the story. He sees the guy at ground zero there. He writes a story about that, but he writes much more than the story. He writes a how-to manual. You want to have your own awakening? You guys over in Oxford, England, you want to do this? I'll show you how to do it. So with that publication, which, by the way, is in America 6 weeks later, it's about what it takes to sail across, and it's being read in the Holy Club that the Wesleys are part of. Actually, they're not there at the moment. It goes viral. This writing goes viral. So lots of people, Europe, England, America, are learning this is what happened at Northampton, the Northampton Revival. And the guy who was at the center of it says, if you want to have that kind of thing going on where you are, this is what you can do. Yeah. So even though Jonathan Edwards is credited with being the person who sparked the Great Awakening, and he is the guy who did that, the key figure is not Jonathan Edwards. He just sparks it. The guy who really gets it going in America and in England is an English Methodist. Now, the Methodist here should be little m, because Methodist is a name given to a group of people who are into this kind of idea of being born again, and they're taking their faith seriously, and they want to be methodical about how they pray. So it's a term of derision that's given at Oxford. It's first given to Charles Wesley, not John, and to a group of his friends. And it's just, you know, these idiots. But they just have OCD. They're just taking religion way too seriously. But the name sticks. And the name becomes a name that then starts to embrace anybody that's like-minded. And within this Methodist group, there's actually three groups. There are the Armenian Methodists, of which John Wesley is a figure. There are the Calvinist Methodists, of which Whitfield is in. And then there is, you love it, the Moravians. And they're Moravian Methodists. Why are they Methodists? Because they're taking their faith seriously. And they're trying to be programmatic. Which we know from Pietism is just what Pietism is. But he gets a new name. The key figure is going to be this really interesting cross-eyed guy, all the pictures, by the name of George Whitfield. Now, he's the guy that's going to pick up the torch. He's the guy who will lead single-handedly the birth of the evangelical revival in England, and he's the guy then that will go back to America and turn the Great Awakening from a local phenomenon into all 13 colonies, transforming it. We'll end there today. So, now, who is he? Well, he was the son of an innkeeper. By the way, he says until he was 15, he basically tended bar. Or he said, I served wine to drunkards. That's what he says. Very successful business until his father died and his mother remarried a jerk who quickly ran the business into bankruptcy. Okay. Now, because of that, the only way he can go to... also, at this point, he has a passion, not for religion. He has a passion for rhetoric and for acting. He's not a professional actor, but he's studying it, which will come very in handy later. He wins awards everywhere, as a child and as a young man. He's just naturally gifted. Okay. Family fell in hard times. He has to go to Oxford as a servitor. Anybody heard that term before? Servitor means you're a servant. Your tuition's paid, but you bathe the wealthy students. You polish their shoes. You do all those kinds of things. It's the lowest level there is at the university. You can be a student, but he's working his way through college. Okay. Very dedicated young man. 1732, while a student at Oxford, he meets this guy, Charles Wesley, and they strike up a friendship. And Wesley has had 3 years earlier, in 29, he had started this little group of students who took their faith seriously, and they got called all kinds of obnoxious names. One of them stuck, the Holy Club, you know. So it's a group of, I think Charles started with four others, and over a period of time, there'd be about 70 in and out, because it lasts for 10 years. It was never over about 20 or 25 people. So, but this young Charles gets involved in that. George. 1733, the members of the Holy Club were among a growing number of people who become convinced of the necessity of being born again. This is not from academic study at the university. This is because they're reading literature. They're reading literature that has come out of the Pietist tradition. A couple of books are hugely influential. Okay. Whitfield borrows the book, The Life of God and the Soul of Man, by Henry Strugel. He borrows it from John Wesley. Because at this point, John Wesley had been off somewhere else. John Wesley's come back. When John Wesley comes back, John Wesley becomes the head of the Holy Club. Okay. Whitfield makes this comment in his journal about the book, so you have an idea of how the book impacted him. It showed me that I must be born again, or... Wow. Remember how the Pietist tradition, we had this idea that being Christian is not something that happens just because you're baptized or because you join a church or because you have certain intellectual beliefs. There was this growing belief, and it's spreading like wildfire now, that it really is of the heart and it is of experience. And out of the Pietist tradition, we get the idea that really what happens when that becomes a reality for you is you're converted. You can already be a Christian, You can already be an ordained minister, but you're going to have a conversion experience. Repenting, turning to God, relying on Holy Ghost. Whitfield's going to have one of these. John Wesley's going to have one of these. Charles Wesley's going to have one of these. It's what's going on at this particular time. 1735, after an intense spiritual struggle in which George Whitfield almost died twice. He is fasting so hard he's not eating. He's praying like 22 hours a day. I mean, you thought Wesley was bad. Okay, yeah. Whitfield is the first member of the Holy Club to have a conversion experience. And it's dramatic. 3 more years before John and Charles Wesley have that experience. That's 1738. So he's sort of the pioneer here. By the way, he's also 10 years younger than the Wesleys. He's very young at this point. He's probably around 20, 21 years old. Okay. 1737, 1738, Charles Wesley and John go to America as missionaries. Why? Because in the early 1700s, this is what you're going to do. You're passionate about your faith. What do we have in America? Heathens. Who do they need? They need Jesus. So, you know, and that's literally what they did. George Whitfield's later going to go over there and do the same thing. Now, this doesn't quite work out for John, but that's a whole different story. That's next week. Whitfield stays behind in England. He takes over leadership of the Holy Club. He's now running it. Why? Well, he's not the oldest, but because of his experience of conversion and because of his passion, he is the obvious leader. He and John Wesley are the two standout obvious leaders. So it's during this period, while Wesleys were in America, that the Holy Club studied, guess what? Jonathan Edwards' book, A Faithful Narrative. So they're reading. This is how you do an awakening, okay? Wesley's not even on the continent, okay? Later the same year, Whitfield then begins laying down the foundations for revival. He's ordained as a minister, and he has no church he's assigned to, but he has friends. And this still happens for young clergy. Your friend invites you to come to their church and preach. So you're a substitute preacher. He starts to do a little bit of that, okay? He starts to substitute preach with his friends in the churches. And by the way, from day one, the word is, whoa. Nobody has ever seen anything like Whitfield. That's going to be both sides, okay? He's dramatic. Well, where did he get that from? Yeah, yeah. He's not frozen chosen in the pulpit. You know, he's all over the place. Okay, highly emotional, weeps, cry. You know, TV preachers. Where did they get it from? Okay, got it from him. Okay. His message is not doctrinal. He is essentially a Calvinist sort of kind of. He hadn't really thought about it much, but his passion is not Calvinist theology. His passion is what's the message? Being born again. This is a necessity. This is why Wesley, who's an Arminian, and Whitfield, who's a Calvinist, can work together, because they're not preaching their theologies, at least not initially. Okay. Whitfield then goes on to quickly create and pioneer the techniques that we define the evangelical revival and the second revival in the 1800s. You think of the list of tools that make evangelicalism what it is. Whitfield almost single-handedly created every single one of them. So what did he do? Well, he's calling for conversion, new birth. That's not new, but he's in that. Emotional appeal is new. Most people, it's the compelling logical argument that drives the sermon. That's what sermons are about. He's not. He's aiming 18 inches lower. He wants to move you out of the pietist tradition. Very dramatic presentation. Other people will mimic him later, but he's the guy that pioneers the stagecraft. He pioneers extemporaneous preaching. The man can preach 3 hours without notes. That impressed Benjamin Franklin, okay? Who heard him, okay? We'll get more from Franklin here in a little bit. He pioneers field, open air, or outdoor preaching. Not in the church. Now, today we know about that, but in the second Great Awakening in the 1800s, the brush arbors and all that, that's what you think of. It's never been done. And it's illegal. This is Church of England, folks. Okay, this is the established church. We have ways of doing things, okay? He also pioneers itinerant preaching. Now, in England, you got parishes, and a minister can preach, they're licensed to preach inside the parish. So, this is my parish, this is your parish. You stay out of my parish, unless you're invited in. Itinerant preaching is you start wandering around, crossing parish lines. Ooh, talk about the bishop getting upset. Okay. The revival officially begins in 1739, but we can see the beginnings in 1737 with Whitfield, not with Wesley. John Wesley's return to America, 1737. Wesley's back in a spiritual crisis, and he is not in any emotional or spiritual condition to lead anything. He's trying to save his own soul, he says. It's going to fall to Whitfield to launch the evangelic revival. Early 1737, Whitfield begins to preach, substitute preaching with his friends. Quickly, reputation. Guys, he's in London. Let's go. He's the cause celeb. He's something to behold. He's a phenomenon from day one. 1739, when Wesley is still struggling with his personal demons, Whitfield adopts two tactics that absolutely revolutionize preaching and officially launch the Great Awakening, the Evangelical Revival, Great Awakening America. The first is outdoor field preaching, and the second is itinerant preaching. These are interesting stories in themselves. Both of these techniques, actually, Whitfield did not pioneer. The credit for that goes to a young Welsh Methodist layman by the name of Hal Harris. Now, Harris is a layman. He's not an ordained minister, so can he preach in a church? This is the Church of England. We've got ways that we do this, okay? He has a dramatic conversion experience. He begins to preach in Wales. He's from Wales, about the new birth that he's experienced. And now, he's not clergy. He's banned from pulpits. He cannot preach, so what's he do? Well, he decides he'll do it outdoors. And he just starts haranguing. You just see this. He just starts grabbing people. He's so excited about his faith, you know. And he does it the only place he could, which is outdoors, to anyone that will actually pay attention and listen to him. Interesting story. Then he begins to itinerate. Another thing that, by the way, is illegal, you cannot do. He moves from place to place as he preached, crisscrossing various parishes. Now, within a few years, he, Wesley, and many others will be all over England. But at this point, we're crossing parish boundaries. Now, since he's not clergy, he's not limited to a specific parish. Let's be honest about this. It means his preaching is equally illegal wherever he goes, okay? He's not licensed to preach by the state, and the state licenses. So, about the same time, Whitfield begins drawing even larger crowds. Some of the numbers you're going to hear, you will not believe. As an ordained Anglican priest, Whitfield preaches in churches, and he preaches only when he's invited by a local pastor, because he's not been assigned by a bishop to a church. Contemporary accounts say his sermons were mesmerizing, you know. No one has ever seen anything like this. We'll get today several accounts of this. But he would shout. He would weep with sorrow. He would tremble with passion as he preached. I mean, nothing else. It's a show, you know. But it's actually going to be much more than that, okay? The result is that people start flocking to hear. He starts getting free publicity in the newspapers of London that this is what you need to do. Contemporary account says people elbowed, shoved, and trampled over themselves to hear the divine things from the famed Whitfield. He's 22 years old. He doesn't have his first church yet, okay? You know, it's an amazing story. He becomes so popular that you can't shoehorn people into the churches. People are literally falling out of the buildings. One sad story, on one occasion, several people are killed before Whitfield arrives because so many pressed in that they were knocked out of the side of the building through the windows, and people fell on them, and they were actually killed. He was not there, but, you know, but this motivates you. You know, we got a problem here. People want to hear the gospel, but we can't physically fit them in. I'm sure that's in the back of his mind. Now, Whitfield actually knew Hal Harris. He had heard of his unorthodox tactics, preaching outdoor, itinerant preaching, and this led Whitfield to making an unprecedented decision that, so far as we know, no ordained preacher in England had ever done before. February 17, 1738, at the suggestion of some friends, Whitfield did the unthinkable. He's in the coal mines of Kingswood, which is near Bristol. There was no church building, Church of England. There's no church building there. But some friends said, Whitfield, there are people here who need God's word. And by the way, coal miners are not exactly the highest level of English society. Would you talk to them? Would you preach to them? It's illegal to do that. In his journal, Whitfield has this marvelous account of what happened. February 17, 1738. After dinner, therefore, I went upon the mount. He's drawing him on the Sermon on the Mount kind of imagery. I spoke to as many people as came unto me. There were upwards of 200. This is at the end of a day. People working in a coal mine. Instead of going home, they're staying and listening to Whitfield. It's remarkable. Blessed be God that I've now broken the ice, which tells you he's been thinking about this. But now the ice is broken. I believe I never was more acceptable to my master than when I was standing to teach those hearers in the open fields. This is the origin of the birth of field or outdoor preaching. Whitfield then follows the example of Hal Harris by doing this, something else that's unorthodox. He begins to itinerate. Now, for Hal Harris, he's a layperson. But for Whitfield, he's an ordained pastor. This is strictly forbidden. He's already written his bishop and told him he did outdoor preaching. I'd love to know what the bishop said back, but haven't read that yet. Okay, he starts preaching just around Bristol, around London, different locations, probably getting lots of invites. And with this, Whitfield becomes the first ordained minister to adopt field preaching, and he's the first ordained minister to adopt itinerant preaching, not Wesley. Wesley's still bound up in this spiritual crisis. Okay, these two innovations are going to enable Whitfield to preach to crowds that could never fit into a building. It also allowed him to preach in locations that he was forbidden to do. By the way, as we go forward, we'll find out from both Whitfield, Wesley, and the others, very quickly they are banned from pulpits. It's within the Anglican Church. This is a renewal. Remember the lay witness movement we had a few decades ago? It's a renewal movement within the church. These are... Yeah. Yeah. Well, allows a bit of a stretch. Okay. Yeah. There are letters flying back and forth. What the heck is going on at Bristol? You know, is that... Yeah. Yeah. Well, at one point here, how can you stop it? When you see the numbers we're about to see, I wouldn't want to be the guy to stick up my head and say, you can't do this. Okay. Okay, it's within a month, Whitfield, we'll pick up this story next week, convinces a very reluctant Wesley to join him in field preaching and then itinerant preaching. This is where Wesley gets it from. Whitfield talked him into it. They're good friends. According to many accounts, this is the part you're simply not going to believe, the crowds began to grow very quickly. Okay, they went from 200 to 2,000. 4,000. 10,000. We're talking within 2 weeks. Crowds get larger. No one had ever seen anything like it. People begin to respond. Obviously, he is tapped into something that is huge. This is not happening by itself. His preaching becomes national news. It becomes international. They're reading about it in Boston. And they're mesmerized by what's going on over there. He is a phenomenon. The crowds climb to 20,000. This is no amplification. Okay. It's calculated that he spoke to more than 25,000 at the Moorfields outside London. That's a public park. By the way, behind him are four criminals who've been hung to death and are simply hanging on the gallows. And around him are people who are throwing various things at him, like pieces of a dead cat, things like this. This is sort of the Moorfield experience, you know. You kind of go out there and people preach stuff, but he begins to do that, okay? Multiple occasions, it's documented he drew crowds of over 30,000. And you begin to wonder, is it even possible to hear? One occasion he's said to have drawn a crowd of 50,000, and on June 1st, 1739, he's reported to have drawn over 80,000 people. By the way, the population of England, this is 1700s. I mean, this is getting up close to the population of London at this point. Yeah. Maybe they couldn't, but they're there. But Ben Franklin calculates, we're going to see this in a minute, that at least 35,000 could have heard him. Could have heard his voice, and Franklin knows why. We'll see it. But do you get the idea of what's going on? This is something unlike anybody's ever seen. Something unprecedented is happening in the British Isles, and it's spreading. And by the way, other people are beginning to do what Whitfield does too. Nobody has his draw, but they're out there. The Wesleys would be among those. Wildfire is going to become the evangelical revival. Only a month after convincing Wesley to adopt outdoor preaching, in the middle of this frenzy of activity, all of a sudden, Whitfield decides to leave England and go to America, which is interesting for several reasons. He leaves the leadership of the revival in the hands of John Wesley. So, what Davy Crockett said, you can go to hell, I'll go to Texas. Yeah, yeah. That kind, yeah. You keep this, I'm moving on. Whitfield is very, very concerned about a orphanage that he wants to get started and fund in America. Okay. With his departure, what's interesting, the evangelical revival, you think it's in Wesley's hands now. Now it's going to grow. No, it doesn't. It grows quiet. Because who's the magnetic figure? The magnetic figure has now gone to America. Okay. The epicenter of the revival now shifts to America and the Great Awakening, which has sort of been there, kind of, sort of, but not much happening. At the center of all this, again, will be George Whitfield. Now, here's the thing, and the same thing was true of Luther. While still in England, Whitfield begins to publish his sermons, publish his journals. So now people who never hear him can read about him or read what he has to say. This resulted in the phenomenal success in Britain being reported in newspaper stories back in Boston and in the United States, or what will be the United States, in America. And America is getting really excited. Whitfield lets it be known in advance that he's coming to America. Promo. And what's America doing? America is just teetering with excitement. The great Whitfield, that's it. He's called the preacher. The preacher is coming to America, okay? When he arrived in America, he's greeted with unprecedented crowds wherever he preached. While in America, he continues to use print media. He's very savvy about this, as was Martin Luther, to communicate his message. He gives advance notice of his speaking engagements. So when he arrives in town, the crowd is pre-assembled, ready to go. Between 1740 and 1742, his publisher, young jack of a guy called Benjamin Franklin, prints 42 books and pamphlets written by Whitfield. So this is where Franklin got his money, I'm sure. Whitfield also brought with him the tools he developed in England. He's brought field preaching, itinerant preaching. By the way, has anybody in America seen these things? No, they've just been invented in England, okay? These practices are as shocking in America as they were in England. By the way, these practices get him banned from every Anglican Church of England pulpit in the area. They will not let him in there. This is way out of the... Plus, preaching this heart faith, just not good stuff. One critic in Connecticut has a very revealing comment. This is what he said. Why, he'll preach outdoors. He'll preach anywhere. Awful, you know. What a terrible thing that a man should preach in the fields or in the streets. Get him out of here, you know. And that's an emotional reaction. It was a very common reaction. No one has ever seen anything like this before. He's now a phenomenon in England. He's a phenomenon in the United States, or what will be the United States. New England Journal, where his reports, they give an account of what he kind of looked like, which is kind of interesting. This December 4th, 1739. He's a man of middle stature, slender body. He gets portly later, but slender body here. Fair complexion, comely experience. Most ready memory. 3 hours? I would say so. Speaks entirely without notes. That's worth noting to people. He has a clear musical voice. Wonderful command of it. He uses much gesture with great propriety. Every accent of his voice, every motion of his body speaks. Get the idea? He's considered by many perhaps to be the greatest preacher in Protestantism, period, up through today. And both are natural and unaffected. If his delivery is a product of art, it certainly is the perfection of it because it's concealed. It doesn't look like art. It looks natural, even if he knows the art. For the next 18 months, Whitfield crisscrosses the American colonies. He's received with unprecedented crowds. Let's talk about some of these crowds. This is America, where the population is a tiny fraction of what it is in England. Well, he preached to over 20,000 people in the Boston Commons. That's interesting, because Boston only has 17,000. Which means people are coming in from distances. He's gotten the word out in advance. This is considered by historians to be the single largest crowd ever gathered in the continental United States up to and including this time. And what are they coming for? To hear a man preach the gospel. It's amazing. Several occasions, people would actually measure the area after the event and calculate the size of the crowd. One of those is Benjamin Franklin. He heard Whitfield preach on numerous occasions in the Boston area, and he made some observations. I'm going to give you two sets of them. The first is similar to New York. He describes Whitfield's style and how he communicates. Then he's going to describe what he thinks is the size of the audience. He said, Whitfield had a loud and clear voice. I'm guessing 30,000 people, you're going to need that. Articulated his words and sentences so perfectly that he might be heard and understood at a great distance. His delivery was so improved by frequent repetitions, if you miss it, you say it again, that every accent, every emphasis, every modulation of the voice, that sound familiar? That's what the New York was saying too, was so perfectly well-tuned and well-placed that even without being interested in the subject, which Franklin was not, one could not help but be pleased with his discourse. Even if you weren't religious, you were compelled. His eloquence has a wonderful power over the hearts and purses. He's raising money for the orphanage, so he would do a call for that, not for himself, but for the orphanages of his hearers. His audience, however numerous, observed the most exact silence. That's kind of how you hear, you know. He calculated on one occasion that Whitfield spoke to a crowd of over 30,000 people in Boston, and Franklin's the scientist. He's going to tell you how he calculated this. He preached one evening from the top of the courthouse steps, which are in the middle of Market Street, and on the west side of 2nd Street, which opposes it at right angles. Both streets were filled with his hearers to a considerable distance. Being among the hindmost in Market Street, I had the curiosity to learn how far could he be heard. By retiring backwards, just starts backing up down the street, listening toward the river, I found his voice distinct till I came near 4th Street, when some noise from the side street obscured it. Imagining then a semicircle of which my distance would be the radius. Didn't he sound like a science guy here?
Yes. Yeah.
And that it were filled with people, each of whom I allowed about 2 square feet. Yeah, got to crunch the math here, you know. I computed that he might have been heard by more than 30,000 people. And then he has an interesting observation. This reconciled me to the newspaper accounts of his having preached to 25,000 people in the fields, which I doubted. But when he crunches the numbers, his voice does in fact carry. Okay. Now, his preaching is not just about numbers, and it's not just about spectacle or show. Franklin comments that when Whitfield left Boston, Boston had changed. He changed the city. Okay, it was his message that powerful. This is what he has to say. It is wonderful to see the change soon made by Whitfield's preaching in the manners of the inhabitants, which at this point were not known for being overly moral, among other things. From being thoughtless or indifferent about religion, it seemed as if all the world was growing religious in Boston, so that one could not walk through the town in the evening without hearing psalms sung by different groups in the street. That's impact. Okay. 1741, after spending 18 months in America, Whitfield returns back to England. He's going to join the evangelical revival in England that John Wesley's been leading during these 18 months. And with his return to England, the momentum of revival is going to shift back to England, which we'll pick up next week. This time, the revival is going to have two leaders, George Whitfield, John Wesley. They're going to be working together. At times, there'll be a tension between them theologically, but Wesley preaches Whitfield's funeral message memorial message in England at the end of his life. So they're together, off and on. Whitfield would leave quite a legacy in America. I'm going to leave you with this because I'm not sure I believe it yet, but this is what we're told. It's estimated that over 80% of the colonists in America personally heard Whitfield preach. He was incredibly inclusive. The churches were not. But outdoors, anybody would be welcome, yeah. It's estimated that one out of seven people in New England had a born-again conversion experience. As a result, historians say that Whitfield came and 18 months later he left. The religious landscape of America had shifted. Now, he's going to come back. He has seven trips to America. None has the impact of this one. This is the one that really has the impact. Yeah, that was transformed. Another part of his legacy, which is mind-blowing, Whitfield, his preaching is considered to be the first event that united the colonies and gave them a sense of common identity. We're not just Georgia, we're not just Massachusetts, we're Americans. Many historians believe that this would, a generation later, lead to the colonies being able to unite in the American Revolution. And had not the Great Awakening happened, there was not a feeling that the colonies would cooperate on anything. But the ice was kind of broke here. So, you glad you heard about Mr. Whitfield? Where was he in the history books? Okay, yeah, yeah. And he is, by the way, a Methodist. He's part of our tradition.